It is the mark of a genius to explain complex things in simple ways. Now, this quote is extremely relevant as I introduce you to our today's guest for the Advaita Decoding Reality podcast. I'm extremely humbled and honored to introduce you to Swami Aparajita Nandaji from Chinmaya Mission. When I listen to various discourses and lectures of Swamiji, the one thing that stands out for me is simplicity. Now, the nature of reality and some of the concepts of Vedanta are very complex. And Swamiji has a beautiful way of explaining these complex subjects in simple ways so that anyone can understand it. And coming to the introduction of Swami Aparajita Nandaji, Swamiji was an electronics and communication engineer before his sannyasa. And for the last decade, he has been working with Chinmaya Mission and he has been sharing his wisdom with thousands of people across the world through his lectures and discourses. Today, we will go deep into Advaita Vedanta, to the nature of reality, and we will also understand how to attain clarity and fulfillment in life through this podcast. Swamiji is currently located at the Yamunotri Center of Chicago in the United States of America. With that, let us get into the podcast. Namaste, Swamiji, and Namaste. Welcome to the Advaita Decoding Reality podcast.
Namaste.
And Swamiji, before we go ahead, let us start with a prayer, a peace invocation from you.
Sahanabhavatu. Sahanau bhunaktu, sahaviryam karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu mavidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shantihi.
Swamiji, at first take some time, Swamiji, to introduce Chinmaya Mission. And before that, in your own life, Swamiji, when you chose the path of spirituality, there are so many schools of thought, there are so many institutions, there are so many ways to go. How did you choose this path and how did you come to choose Chinmaya Mission?
Yeah. So it so happened that after finishing my engineering studies in Kerala, I came to Bangalore. So I had all my friends there in Bangalore. So in those times, Bangalore was an IT hub. So I went there to search a job along with my friends. So it so happened that I got a job in one engineering college as a lecturer. And it so happened that my house was just 5 minutes walkable distance from nearest Chinmaya Mission. So that's how I came in touch with Chinmaya Mission. And the teaching appealed to me very much because the whole knowledge was given in so logical, convincing way. So for my logical mind, it appealed very much.
Yeah.
I used to go to other organizations also. But I felt the pull here because I had a lot of questions, a lot of doubts. And they were convincingly answered in Pooja Gurudev Swami Chinmayanji's talk. So that's how I was attracted to this mission.
Swamiji, Chinmaya Mission itself, it was, as we know, was started by Swami Chinmayanandaji. And apart from that, for people who do not know about the institution, how would you introduce it to them?
See, the whole organization, in fact, was started by Swami Chinmayananda. And in the beginning, his name was, before taking sannyas, his name was Balakrishna Menon. And he was an atheist. He was a journalist. So, in fact, he went to the Himalayas, Rishikesh, to meet at that time a very famous saint called Swami Shivanji Maharaj of Divine Life Society. So, he went there to interview Swamiji and to prove to the world how these Swamijis are leeches in the society. Not contributing anything to the society, only taking from the society. So he was, he had gone there to expose Swamiji. And it so happened that he went there in the ashram and he was stunned, because morning they would get up and there is yoga, pranayama, meditation, bhajans, and the whole day will be going in selfless service. And Swami Shivanji himself was a well-educated person. He was a very famous doctor in Malaysia who left everything and became a Swamiji. And the whole environment was filled with so much of spiritual vibration. There was no meat eating, no alcohol, no smoking. In fact, Balakrishna Menon was the only one who was smoking. So he felt so ashamed looking at his own life and the way people were living their life in that ashram. So within, I think, 6 months or so, he took sannyas. He read the books of Swami Shivanji Maharaj. It was so much inspiring for him. He understood that there was a better way of living, a more divine way of living. And then it was Shivanji Maharaj who directed Pooja Gurudev to Swami Taponji Maharaj, who was at that time a very famous scholar in the Himalayas. So he gained the knowledge from them. And finally, he found that peace promised by the scriptures. And then every day he used to go to, you know, take bath. Swamiji used to go to Ganga to take bath. So there he gained the inspiration. Swamiji felt that Mother Ganga was talking to him. Oh, my dear son, look at me. I flow from the Himalayas and I flow towards the plains to blessing the entire humanity, to bless the entire humanity. Isn't it your responsibility also? Now that you have gained this knowledge, isn't it your responsibility to bring this knowledge to the common man in the plains who are suffering? You have gained this knowledge. Now, isn't it your responsibility to give this knowledge to everyone? So just like me, why don't you come down? So the inspiration was from Mother Ganga. And Pooja Gurudev started his... It is said that in the first talk, there were only some 4 or 5 people. And slowly the crowd gathered. And there was a lot of opposition also for Pooja Gurudev, especially from the orthodox corners. They said scripture should not be spoken in English language. It should be spoken only in Sanskrit. And this knowledge should be given only to the Brahmanas. Pooja Gurudev did not care about any of those criticisms. He went on with his mission. And people were also benefiting, and therefore more and more invitations he started receiving for giving talks. It is said that the complaint even went to Kanchi Shankaracharya also. And it is said that Shankaracharya of that Kanchi Matha, he said, when Sakshat Saraswati is dancing on his turn, who can stop him? Allow him to spread the knowledge of the scriptures. So this knowledge found great appeal among the common masses because, you know, all the scriptural knowledge, it was restricted to some rare ashrams in those times. And people had this feeling that this knowledge is meant only for the sannyasis, for the retired people, for people who have nothing else to do. They never knew that this knowledge was something which was necessary for us to live our day-to-day life in facing the challenges of life. So Gurudev brought that knowledge of the scriptures to the common man, saying that this knowledge is useful for everyone, whether it is children, youth, or elderly people. This knowledge is useful for everyone. It is the manual of right living. So just as we read the manual first before using a device, and then only we use the device, in the same way, to live in this complicated world with this complicated body and mind, we need guidance. And the guidance has to come from Bhagawan himself. And Bhagawan has given this guidance in the form of scriptures. So the study of scriptures is absolutely essential if we have to live a fruitful life.
Yes.
So in this way, the knowledge of the scripture, Pooja Gurudev made it, what you call, relevant.
Accessible to everyone. Yeah.
Accessible to everyone.
Yes. And also for people who are interested to learn more about Chinmaya Mission and the story of how it all started, there is a beautiful movie on Swami Chinmayanandaji. Which was made by Chinmaya Mission. So I will share the link for that so people can get access to that.
Yes.
And Swamiji, in my own life, in my teenage, I was not very interested in the concept of God, in spirituality or anything like that in particular. I was simply involved with my life when I say teenage, I'm 13, 14, 15 years old. I never gave thought to it. And even the concept of God, It seems that there are around 3,200 recorded religions in the world today. And every religion, and even within, religion, every philosophy, they say that only our God is right. Almost every religion says this, not the Sanatana Dharma, but they say that only our God is right, only our way is right. So something didn't make sense to me, and that path didn't interest me of God and spirituality. Until in my search, I came to the teachings of Advaita Vedanta and the teachings of Adi Guru Shankaracharya. So once I began to understand this philosophy of non-duality and Advaita Vedanta, like for me, everything began to make sense, like all the religions, all the teachings and all the books that I had read and everything. So let's start there, Swamiji. Let us start with the basic premise of Advaita Vedanta and a basic introduction to Adi Guru Shankaracharya and his contributions to this world and to the Sanatana Dharma.
See, Advaita Vedanta is very logical and it is convincing to all. So what is the basic principles? Now, there is a very, very beautiful commentary. It's called as Adhyasa Bhashya, written by Bhagavan Shankaracharya while writing the commentary on Brahma Sutras. So that gives the essence of the entire knowledge of Advaita Vedanta. Mm. So what is that? So in essence, we will just discuss that. So there is something called superimposition, or what we call as identification theory. So what is this theory? When entity A identifies with entity B, the properties of B appear to be the properties of A. This is called as superimposition theory or identification theory. When entity A identifies with entity B, the properties of B appear to be the properties of A. To understand this theory clearly, let us take the example of this film theater. We enter into the theater, and then what happens? Slowly we get totally absorbed in the movie. And then what happens? Suppose I identify with the hero. Now hero's emotions become my emotions. When hero is sad, I am sad. When the hero is crying, I am crying. When hero is happy, I am happy. So now what happens? The movie world becomes a real world for me. The movie character becomes a real character. The movie happenings become the real happenings for me. So now, in the movie theater, if I am crying, what is the cause of my sorrow? The cause of my sorrow is not my problems of my life. No, the cause of my sorrow is the sorrow of that illusory character in the movie. Say the hero in the movie. So if I have to put an end to the sorrow in the movie theater, what should I do? I have to do only one thing. Disidentify from what I am not. Identify with what I am. Detach from what I am not. Attach to what I am. Vedanta says this is exactly what we have to do in our life also. So in Vedanta also we have two entities. One is consciousness, the other is matter. So anything made of five elements is matter. So the entire world is made of five elements. Five elements means space, air, fire, water, earth. Five elements. Anything made of five elements is matter. So the whole world is matter. The physical body is also matter because the body is nourished by food. Food is nothing but matter. Even the mind is also made of matter. Because when we don't eat food, when we fast, the mind becomes silent. So that means the mind is nourished by food. So mind is also nothing but subtle matter. There is only one thing which is not matter, and that is consciousness in us. And what is the nature of consciousness? Advaita Vedanta says this consciousness is infinite. It is immortal. It is bliss. It is perfection absolute. So whatever we are truly desiring is already there in this consciousness. And that is my true nature. Every one of us, we are nothing but this infinite immortal consciousness. And what is the mistake we have done? Instead of knowing myself as I am, as consciousness, I identify myself with the body. Now, according to this theory, whatever I am identified with, that I will start experiencing. My experience will depend on not upon what I am, but with what I am identified with. So if I'm identified with a physical imperfect body, so then I will start experiencing imperfection. And will I be happy with imperfection? No. Since my nature is perfection, I cannot be satisfied with imperfection. Since my nature is immortality, I cannot be happy with this mortal body. Since my nature is infinite bliss, I cannot be happy with sorrows of the world. So every one of us, we are struggling to come out of this sorrow. We are struggling to come out of this state of mortality. We are struggling to come out of this imperfection. So what does Advaita Vedanta say? Know yourself. You don't have to do anything because perfection is already your nature. It is already you. You don't have to create it. You don't have to attain it. You have to just know yourself as you are. So this is the beauty of Advaita Vedanta. What you call the whole science is so logical, so perfect, and it is so convincing.
Yeah. And this was there in the scriptures from the beginning, from thousands of years. But yes. It is said that the entire Sanatana Dharma went through some dark period where they missed these teachings and Shankaracharya revived it. So can you talk a little bit about Shankaracharya and what he has done?
I am told that at that time when Bhagavan was born, there were some 72 different schools of philosophies who were fighting with each other. Proving that they alone were right. So what Bhagavan Shankaracharya did was, he did a healthy debate with all of them. Healthy debate in the sense trying to understand what the reality is. Not arguing to win, but arguing to know. And in this way, it is said that Bhagavan defeated all those different schools of philosophies and finally established Advaita Vedanta
as the ultimate.
Yes.
Swamiji, one of the most famous things that Adiguru Shankaracharya said was Brahma Satya Jagat Mitya Jiva Brahma Ivanapara. So the consciousness alone is real. The world as we see it is an appearance, and individual Jiva is one with that infinite consciousness.
Yes.
And we create a lot of videos and content around the topic of Advaita Vedanta in our channel. And one of the issues and one of the comments that we keep getting is about the nature of Maya. So if what Advaita Vedanta says is that there is only one consciousness, then what is this Maya and where is this Maya? So people from different other philosophies and people who do not understand it, they have a lot of questions about Maya. So what is the nature of this Maya, Swamiji?
So we have so many definitions with regard to what this Maya is. One definition is Yama Samaya. That which is not is Maya. This one definition. The second definition is Brahmashraya Maya. This Maya has no independent existence, but it exists upon Brahman, the ultimate reality. Another definition is Avarana Vikshepatmika Maya. What does this Maya do? It does Avaranam and Vikshepa. Avarana means it covers the reality, and Vikshepa means it projects the unreal as real. Avarana and Vikshepa. These are the two powers of Maya. Another one is Trigunatmika Maya. This Maya is made of three gunas, Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. So now, what does this Maya do? So it covers the reality and projects the unreal as real. So what happens is, we experience certain things, but that need not be real. So the example given is like the dream world. In the dream, we see a dream world. And we experience that dream world also. But when we wake up to the reality, we come to know that the whole dream world was actually a projection of the mind. The projection of a dreaming mind. So this is what Maya does. It covers the reality. So in the dream, the waker was always there as the very observer of the dream. He was always there. But what does the Maya do? It covers. So therefore, the reality is not seen. In the place of reality, the unreal is seen. So Maya projects an unreal world. So this is how Advaita Vedanta describes. So everything which is born out of Maya also will have the property of Maya. So we say mind is born out of Maya. So if you see the mind, the thoughts, you will find that when the thoughts are in the mind, you observe these thoughts and the thoughts will vanish. So is a thought there? No, it was just an appearance. So this is what Maya does.
And the immediate question that we get and that comes to the mind is, the consciousness is described as Nitya, Shuddha, Mukta. It is described as ever free. It is ever liberated and it is pure. And yes. Maya is a, as we know, it is a projection and it conceals the reality. So these are the properties of Maya. Yes. And saying that Maya is in consciousness is like saying that there is darkness in the sun. So this is kind of a contradiction. And I wanted to ask, Maya and Avidya are literally the same, right, Swamiji? Avidya and Maya.
Correct.
So yes. by its nature, Avidya doesn't exist. So in a way, we can say that Maya doesn't exist and exist at the same time. So it cannot be described any further.
See, yes, true. Maya doesn't exist, but it appears to exist.
Just like ignorance. Yes. Ignorance about any subject, it doesn't exist as a positive entity, but not doesn't exist also, yeah.
Correct. For example, like the blueness of the sky, they say, you know. You are seeing it, but actually it is not there. Yeah. The mirage waters, you are seeing it, but actually it is not there. That snake in the rope, these are all the famous examples of Vedanta. The snake in the rope, you are seeing it, but actually it is not there.
Yeah, what is there is only the pure consciousness in it.
Correct.
And Swamiji, in Vedanta, we talk about Chit and Chidabhasa. Chit is the pure consciousness and Chidabhasa is the channeled or reflected consciousness.
Yes.
So basically, right now, when we are unconsciously living our lives, we are using this Chidabhasa to live our lives. And what is this relationship between Chitta and Chidabhasa?
See, Chidabhasa is sometimes called as reflected consciousness. Now, if the consciousness has to reflect, there has to be a reflecting medium. So the reflected light is actually a combination of two things. One is the original light and the second is the reflecting medium. So you will find that in the reflected light, there is a property of original light also, that light itself. And there is a property of this reflecting medium. If the medium is dull, the reflection is dull. If the medium is shaky, the reflection is shaky. If the medium is broken, the reflection is broken. So reflected light is a combination of the original light and the properties of reflecting medium. In the same way, who are we? So Vedanta says we are a combination of two. This ego. We, in the sense, this Jivatma or the ego. Ego is a combination of two entities. One is consciousness, the other is body-mind-intellect. So consciousness plus body-mind-intellect equal to ego, which we call as reflected consciousness. It is reflected. Reflected where? In the mind. So if the mind is a dull mind, that personality will be a dull personality. If that mind is a very cheerful, dynamic mind, that personality will be a dynamic personality, you see. So it's a combination.
So just like how sunshine, the sun shines on everything and it makes everything visible, based on our nature, consciousness channels through it.
Correct.
In the same question, if we go a little deeper, if I right now sit and close my eyes, if I actually go in search of that ego, we don't find anything like ego as such. When we are unconscious, of course, it is active. But when we become conscious and if we sit in meditation, that is not there. So when it is not there, am I experiencing Chit or Chidabhasa?
See, first of all, we have to understand what this ego is. This ego is the understanding which I have about myself. This wrong notion which I have about myself, that is called as ego, or sometimes Bhagavan Ramana Maharshi calls it as aham vritti. So that understanding about myself I have gained by just observation, not by the study of scriptures. So I find that when this body was born, I was born. When this body is going to die, I am going to die. So therefore, the first notion is, I am this body. This is an understanding about me. This is a notion about me. This bundle of notion about me, which defines a self, is called as ego or the ahamvritti. It is a thought. Any notion is a thought. Any understanding is a thought. So I have certain thoughts about myself. I have certain understanding about myself. This bundle of understanding, this bundle of notion is what is called as ego. So what is ego? It is nothing but a thought bundle. So when I sit in meditation, at the back of the mind, I am aware that I am nothing but this ego. I am nothing but this body who is sitting there. So now, when I close my eyes, I see so many thoughts. Right? Now, these thoughts are called idam vritti. Idam vritti means this thought. Thought about the world. Thought about the things, beings, and situations of the world. But where is the thought about I? It is this ego which is witnessing. It is aham vritti which is witnessing the idam vritti. The I thought is witnessing the this thought. So please understand the layers. The first is pure consciousness.
Consciousness.
Upon consciousness is this I thought. And upon I thought is this thought, idam vritti. So there are three layers. So generally when we sit for meditation, generally we are at the I thought level witnessing the this thought.
Okay.
Because even we never question I thought. We never question the I thought because we think I know myself. What is there to inquire? So when I thought witnesses the this thought, the law of meditation is the moment you witness a thought, that thought disappears. You identify with the thought and the thought multiplies. You witness a thought and the thought disappears. This is a law of witnessing. So when the I thought is witnessing the this thought disappears. But the I thought remains. The ego remains. In order to destroy this I thought, there is only one way. We have to step one step back and start witnessing this I thought. That also should become an object of witnessing, the I thought. And Bhagavan Ramana Maharshi says, the moment you start witnessing the I thought also vanishes because it is nothing but thought. And then what remains? Only pure consciousness remains. The ego dissolves, and what the reality is, that alone remains.
But how can we differentiate between witnessing the idam vritti and the aham vritti itself? Like you explained, Swamiji, when we sit for meditation, for if we practice a little bit, the thoughts begin to dissolve. But you're saying even that dissolution is happening for the idam vritti.
Yes.
So what will be the difference, or how can we go about witnessing the I thought itself?
See, that is why the first step in spirituality is not meditation. It is selfless service, because you need extreme purity of mind to witness the I thought. You have to even objectify the ego itself. The ego itself should be objectified. Generally, what happens is we are so used to getting identified with the ego that we live generally to pamper the ego. So this is a wrong way of living. So the first step in spirituality is not meditation. The first step in spirituality is selfless service, where you are serving the world, dissolving your individuality for the welfare of the totality. So you are training your mind to dissolve the ego. And this is something which can be done everywhere, whether it is in sports, whether it is family, whether it is an organization, everywhere. If I am living a life in such a way that I am giving importance to the samashti, the totality, and not giving and not giving importance to the individuality, when I am living such a selfless way, working for the benefit of the totality, not living a selfish life, not living an egocentric life, when in this way I start working, what happens is I start gaining purity of mind. The entire third chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Karma Yoga, is nothing but this. There the importance given to the yajna karma. Yajna means sacrifice. Wherever you are, sacrifice yourself for the welfare of the totality. Yajnyarthat karmanonyatra lokoyam karma bandhanah Tadartham karma kaunteya mukta sangha samachara, Bhagavan says. Any action done other than this yajna spirit will bind you. Bind you means what? Will make the ego more and more strong.
Stronger.
The more and more I live an egocentric life, the ego becomes stronger and stronger. And this I, ahamvritti, becomes stronger and stronger. And the more this ego becomes stronger, I am away and away from the Lord. Because it is this ego which is preventing me from experiencing my own true nature. The wheel is the ego. So the more and more I live a selfish life, the more and more ego becomes strong. And the more and more this wheel of ego becomes strong, more and more I am away from the Lord. So the ego is preventing me from knowing my own true infinite nature. So what is the intelligent way of living? Even while living in this world, even even while performing our duties and responsibilities in this world, if I can live in such a way that, you know, I live a selfless life for the welfare of all, then in the process, the what you call the ego wheel becomes thinner and thinner. Mind becomes purer and purer. In third chapter, Bhagavan says, Tasmat sarvagatam brahma nityam yajna pratishthitam. Bhagavan says, the way to reach me is yajna. The one who knows how to sacrifice himself for the welfare of the totality, such a person alone has entry into my kingdom. That's what Bhagavan says. So, when I live such a selfless life, performing all my duties as a worship of the Lord, for the welfare of the totality, dissolving my individuality, in a spirit of cooperation and not competition, without ego and egocentric desires, when I start living such a life, such actions purify my mind. And in such a pure mind, at the seat of meditation, I am very clearly able to see this ahamvritti very much different from me. I am able to witness it. You see, to witness something, that thing has to be away from you, isn't it?
Yes.
The more and more it is close to me, the more and more witnessing becomes difficult because it is becoming a part of me. When something is away from me, I am able to see it. I am able to objectify it. So this has to be done. So that is why karma yoga is the first step. Dhyana yoga comes later. Meditation is later. First is selfless, selflessly serving the society. Yes.
Okay. And this aham vritti, Swamiji, we are born with this. Everyone is born with this. Since consciousness is the fundamental thing that only exists, this ego cannot be in positive identity by itself, right? It is simply a temporary
bundle of wrong notions.
Yeah, bundle of wrong notions. And if we inquire on it, it disappears.
Correct.
Yeah. And Swami Vivekananda, Swamiji, in his works, the complete works of Swami Vivekananda, in one of his lectures, he says, Karma Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Raja Yoga, and Jnana Yoga, each of these paths by themselves have the capability to take an individual to the ultimate reality. But it is highly recommended to make use of all these paths, like all the support systems. Because why wouldn't you take? According to that statement, even Jnana Yoga, just intellectual inquiry alone can take us there. Like, what would you say to this?
See, for practicing deeper meditation, you need extreme purity of mind. If the mind is not pure, that meditator will experience certain obstacles. And the first obstacle is good sleep. So he will sit for meditation and then he will go to sleep because there is no strength, there is no purity. So two qualifications necessary for efficient meditation is Chitta Shuddhi and Chitta Ekagrata. Chitta Shuddhi means purity of mind. Chitta Ekagrata means concentration of mind. Only with these two qualifications, a person can really progress. So a person who has no purity of mind, if he sits for meditation, he will snore away to sleep. This is first obstacle. The second obstacle, even if he doesn't sleep, he will find that his mind is wandering. The mind will think of so many things. Karmendriyani sanyamya ya aste manasa smaran indriyarthan vimudhatma mithyachara sa uchyate. Bhagavan says that in third chapter. So naturally, because Bhagavan gives these two paths. One is a path for the beginner, the another is the path for the advanced. Jnana yogena sankhyanam karma yogena yoginam. For the advanced seeker, it is Jnana yoga. For the beginners, it is karma yoga. This is what Bhagavan says.
What is the difference between an advanced seeker and a beginner?
This is a test. How will I know whether I'm a beginner or an advanced? Just sit at the seat of a meditation, see what you are capable of doing. So for a beginner, either he will go to sleep or he will find his wandering mind and he's not even able to understand how. See, for the beginner, mind is wandering and he's not even aware that the mind is wandering. Even to become aware of the wandering mind, you need some purity.
He's used to it.
So these are the obstacles which a beginner who has not purified his mind will experience. So Bhagavan says, don't waste your time unnecessarily sitting hours together in meditation. Get into the field of action and then selflessly perform your action, which will purify the mind. And with such a pure mind, when you sit for meditation, your meditation will be successful. But remember one thing, even otherwise also 15-20 minutes of meditation is good, because unless I know the imperfection of my mind, I will not be inspired to purify my mind.
Yes.
In this sense, meditation for the beginner is also advised.
To know. And as we practice it, we get better at it.
Absolutely, yes. Yes. Yeah.
And Swamiji, in your discourses and in your lectures, you give a lot of importance to bhakti, devotion, and even karma yoga. You usually say that the ultimate realization or enlightenment is possible only through the grace of God. No matter how much we work, if I go through the scriptures and if I am genuinely seeking, and since there is that only one infinite consciousness and it is my true nature, first of all, devotion is absolutely a beautiful path, and it's a easy path because we are, you know, delegating the responsibility to that Lord. So we are in the back seat. So I understand the concept of devotion and I enjoy it a lot. But just intellectually, if we think about it, there are certain other philosophies and other religions like Buddhism, Shunyatavada, where devotion is not mentioned a lot. And even in Sanatana Dharma, the path of yoga, the Ashtanga Yoga, devotion is not doesn't have a major place there. It's simply the purification of the mind and meditations and asana, pranayama, pratyahara. So there is no concept of grace there. How would you explain this, Swamiji?
You see, is it possible to consciously enter into sleep?
No.
Because sleep is a state where ego is dropped. So can ego drop itself by itself?
No.
Some other entity has to drop the ego. Ego cannot drop itself. The more and more I try to drop the ego only becomes strong, isn't it?
That other entity is me, myself, in the sense, my true self.
True, but at present I am not aware of that, no.
So now I'm separated from it.
Yes. As an ego, I cannot drop the ego. I need a higher entity. That higher entity is called God or consciousness. Okay. That devotion for consciousness, that love for consciousness, that is emphasized here. Unless I hold on to the higher, I cannot drop the lower.
Yeah, this is the basic premise of bhakti yoga.
Correct.
Yeah, I understand it. But I'm saying, like, let's say in Ashtanga Yoga, the yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana. So this is the process that they take us through. I'm asking, here, the way it is explained in the Yoga Sutras and the translations of the Yoga Sutras, this is simply, we are making ourselves more and more, we are cleansing ourselves, we are cleansing our system. At some point, our mind and our body is so pure that that divinity manifests within us.
Yes.
So in this process, there is no mention of devotion.
You see, in Yoga Sutra, let us not say that there is no devotion. There is Ishara Pranidhanam. That's very, very important. Ishara Pranidhana means surrendering unto God.
Okay.
So actually, what is this cleaning the mind? It is nothing but effacing the ego.
Yes.
Cleaning the mind is not that some dust is there and you are cleaning it. No. The impurity of the mind is nothing but kama, krodha, lobha, moha, mada, matsarya, anger, lust, greed, all those negative emotions. Who is the root cause of all these negative emotions? The ego.
Ego.
So therefore, the impurity of the mind is nothing but the ego. So purification of the mind is nothing but effacing the ego. What is effacing the ego? Effacing the ego is nothing but saying that God, not me, but you, not me, but you. So what am I doing there? I am actually dropping the ego by holding on to God, by paying attention to God. Remember, the terms may be different. Devotion means being devoted. Being devoted means what? Paying attention. Sorry. In the language of knowledge, the same term devotion becomes paying attention. It's not crying and weeping and sentiments. No.
Yes.
In all the paths, whether it is Buddhist path, every path, that very inspiration for that person to perform, you know, that sadhana comes from that his devotion for the higher reality. Being devoted to. How does that being devoted to express itself? By paying attention. By not forgetting that ultimate reality. These are all the expressions of devotion only.
Yes, beautifully said. Yes.
I'm holding on to something. I'm not leaving it. Even when there are worldly attractions, I'm not leaving it. I'm constantly paying attention to it. That itself is an expression of devotion.
Devotion.
That is called being devoted to truth. You may call it truth. You may call it God. You may call it consciousness. Terms can be different.
Devotion is needed.
One thing is needed, you have to give importance to that reality. Only then it will manifest in your life.
Correct. True. Adiguru Shankaracharya Swamiji, in some of his works like Aparokshanubhuti, gives a tremendous amount of importance to jnana. Like he said, like even if you put all the, you know, ingredients within a vessel, unless you light the fire, nothing will do. So, So jnana and bhakti, these two are given extraordinary amount of importance in every path. So how to approach this, and how can a seeker approach jnana versus bhakti?
See, there is actually nothing called jnana versus bhakti. It is always jnana plus bhakti. And it is bhakti. Always together. In fact, jnana, karma and bhakti, they always go together. Actually, they are not three different paths. They are actually one path only. And as a person grows in one path, the other two also manifest. It is exactly like, you know, a mother loves her child. So what comes first? Knowledge. So mother knows that this is my child, and therefore the emotion of love comes, isn't it? So see that jnana and bhakti. There it is, preeti. And therefore she is ready to do anything for the child. That doing is karma. So, jnana, bhakti and karma, they go together. Once you start knowing God, you cannot but love God. And once you start loving God, you cannot but dedicate your life for God. They three always go together. It is just not possible that a person has got jnana about Bhagavan, but no love for Bhagavan. It is not possible. A person has love for Bhagavan, but no jnana about Bhagavan. Not possible. Illogical. See, I cannot love a stranger. Is it possible to love a stranger? Impossible. Unless I know about a person, I cannot love that person. And then I cannot serve that person also. So these three, they always go together.
There is just one reality. And going closer and closer to it, all three paths are manifested.
One reality, with what personality you approach, accordingly it will manifest. When you are approaching with your intellectual personality, then there is expression of jnanam, knowledge. When you are approaching the reality with your emotion, then there is bhakti in your heart, devotion. And when you are expressing your love for that knowledge as action, then there is an expression of physical personality. So all your personalities, they express your knowledge, your devotion, love in different aspects.
Absolutely. And I wanted to talk about this later on, but it makes perfect sense. Like, since I started studying Advaita Vedanta a few years back, I didn't consciously, you know, chose devotion and devotional practices as such. But as I study this more and more, and as I understand this more and more, naturally, I'm going to temples more and more. I'm every day when I wake up, I go to the puja room, which I was not doing before. Now I'm simply using my intellect, but somehow that devotion is being manifest. Once you said this, it makes perfect sense.
And also, this knowledge has got three levels, inferior levels and superior levels. Just gathering information is also called knowledge. You read some book and you get some idea. That is also called knowledge, but that is an inferior knowledge. That is gained through Shravanam. Shravana Janita Jnanam. Knowledge gained by reading books, some information. Then there is a Manana Janita Jnanam. You reflect upon it, you clear all doubts, and now you are convinced. So that conviction is a higher stage of knowledge. And there is a Nididhyasa Janita Jnanam. Out of your own out of your own experience, you have a knowledge. So experiential knowledge is always superior to informative knowledge. So knowledge has got different levels. That knowledge which is your direct experience, it is of far higher nature than just bookish knowledge. In the same way, bhakti also has got different levels. There is a bhakti due to my affliction. You know, I love God because he is very useful in solving my problems. Many people go to temple because there are so many desires. God fulfills all my desires. Therefore, I love God. So that's a transactional love. So it's an inferior love. It's an unconditional love. Artha bhakti, artharthi bhakti it is called. Then there is a jnani bhakti. Jnani bhakti is the devotion of a jnani. One who truly has understood that God is nothing but one's own self. His devotion will be far higher compared to this lower devotion. So devotion has also got different levels. Knowledge also has got different levels. As I grow in knowledge, my devotion also start growing. So,
and I always wondered how the jnanis can express devotion, because for them it is the reality of their own self. But still, I don't think we intellectually we can get it, but somehow it is not contradictory to them. They see the Ramakrishna Paramahamsa is a great example of an extreme devotee and an extreme jnani, like both at the same time. But intellectually, I always thought about it. It didn't make any sense. But yeah, both are one and the same.
Correct.
And Swamiji, just to introduce the people to the creation of the universe, I think Tattva Bodha talks about the creation of the Panchabhutas and the various stages of the creation of the universe. Can you take us through that journey?
See, basically the world is created to fulfill our desires. Because who is desiring? None other than Bhagavan is desiring. Who is the Jivatma? So the essence of Vedanta is Tattvamasi Aham Brahmasmi. So as a Jivatma, I am desiring something. I may not know that I am Paramatma, but the fact is I am Paramatma. So when Jivatma, the ego, when we are desiring something, it is actually Bhagavan who is desiring something. And when Bhagavan desires something, the cosmos, the Prakriti has to manifest it. It is like when the king is ordering, you know, his order has to be implemented. So in the same way, every desire that we are entertaining, actually the cosmos is designed to manifest that desire in the outer form.
But although many, like in that way, many people desire a lot of things, it's not always the case that it will always come to them immediately, right?
If your desire is from the depth of your heart, if that desire is sincere, then it will definitely manifest. Many times what happens is I have desire one, then after some time I have desire two, which is opposing desire one. So it is something like a person walking two steps forward, three steps backward, five steps forward. So finally he's not reaching anywhere because he's walking in all directions. So in the same, constantly we are having thousands of desires pulling us in thousands of ways. And that is why nothing is manifested. But if we can have one desire constantly, again and again, if we can go on pursuing it, that desire has to manifest. And the world is designed to manifest that desire.
And this is what the modern teachers call law of attraction manifestation, I think.
Yes.
This is how the universe is.
Yes.
And apart from that, Swamiji, there are different theories on the reality. Drishti Srishtivada, Srishti Drishtivada, and then we go on to one of the first books on Vedanta many, many years ago that I picked up was Mandukya Upanishad, which was translated by Swami Chinmayanandaji. So at that time, it didn't make any sense. I read a few pages and I kept it, but later on, I picked it up again and I started studying it. And there, Gaudapadacharya, so his doctrine was the theory of Ajatavada, that there is no creation as such. And that is the ultimate truth.
Yes.
And many other schools of Vedanta and many other Swamiji say that it is contradicting the scriptures like that. How can you say God has not created anything? So how can we understand this one?
See, in spirituality, we have different levels, depending upon different levels of the students. Mm. Mm. Just like in the school, we have LKG, UKG, first standard, second standard, 10th standard, PhD. So depending upon the level of the student, the syllabus also changes. We cannot have one syllabus for everyone, isn't it? Mm. To give a very simple example, when the child is very small, we say, sun rises from the east, sets in the west. That's what we tell the child. Mm. And once the child grows up, then we say, there is no rising, no setting. Sun never rises, never sets. You see? Mm. So depending upon the evolution, the knowledge also we give them different in the same way. In the beginning, we say, yes, there is creation, there is world, because that's what we are seeing. Mm. To tell a beginner that there is no world, it will not help him, because he is seeing a world and he is having problems in the world. To tell him that there is no world is actually not helping him. So then we have to come down to his level. So what is his level? World is there. I am there. Ego is there. And I have so many problems. Mm. So then the spiritual teaching come down to his level. So that, you know, for a person who is in step zero, step one is helpful.
Yes.
Step 10 may be the ultimate. But for him, step 10 is of no use. Step one is more useful, though it is lower.
Yes.
For a person who is step one, step two is more useful.
Mm. At that point, so that is the truth for them.
Exactly. See, for the child who is in the womb, the world is of no use. That womb is the world. And womb is the most helpful thing, because it can survive only in the womb. The world doesn't have that necessary capacity to help the child. So the child has to remain in the womb for 9 months. The womb alone can help the child grow. And once he has grown, I mean, fully in the womb, then the womb is no more useful. He has to come into the world. In the same way, for the beginners, the world is very much useful. Never we should say that world is, you know, the illusion and it doesn't exist and all. No. Though that may be the ultimate reality, though that may be absolute truth, but it is also absolutely useless. Truth can be absolutely true, but it can be absolutely useless also, depending upon my level.
Yes.
So therefore, in the beginning, we don't say world is unreal, etc. We say, yes, world is there. And how to win over the, you know, different kinds of emotion. And once a person becomes really mature, sattvic, we say, when the mind is sattvic, when the mind has become pure, for such a person, the instruction given is, now witness the mind and silence the mind. Not purify the mind, but transcend the mind. So there are two stages, as in the pole vault, you know. In the beginning, that pole vaulter, he runs, fixes the pole, climbs the pole, and there is a time when he has to drop the pole. If you see that pole vault game.
Yes, yes.
But suppose he is told, see, anyway, you have to drop the pole. So in the beginning only you drop, no? Why do you want to drop in the end? So it is meaningless.
Yeah.
So there is a time when the pole has to be used, and there is a time when the pole has to be dropped.
Let go. Correct.
So in the same way, there is a time when the world has to be used. World is useful for our growth. From tamas to rajas, from rajas to sattva. It is very useful. World is useful. It helps purify the mind. And once we have reached a sattvic state, then you have to drop the world. You have to drop the mind. And that is what Gaudiya Padacharya says when he says there is no world at all.
So for that is the ultimate level, we can say.
Ultimate level, because the world is experienced by the mind. The world has no existence without mind.
There is reality only with the mind.
Exactly. Only with the mind we are experiencing the world. Now we are questioning the very mind itself. Does the mind exist? So Ramana Maharshi says, Manasam tu kim margane krite naiva manasam. Are, when you inquire the nature of the mind, mind itself is not there. When the mind is not there, anything born out of the mind, anything projected by the mind also disappears.
And Swamiji, here I was thinking about all this from some time now, and within my mind, just to make sense of it, the mind keeps coming up with a theory. So I'll just take a few minutes to explain to you my understanding, and I wanted to take some inputs from you. So this I call this the theory of everything. And you know, the starting point for this is the Shanti Mantra from Ish Upanishad. Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate. So that is in that God is infinite, this Jiva is infinite, and from that infinite has come this infinite. And if we take away this infinite from that infinite, what remains is still the infinite.
Yes.
So at one level, Swamiji, this what this mantra seems like it is saying is that there is one absolute infinite, and then there is another infinite that has come from it, and there is some kind of a relationship with it. But if we go just one step further to another level, like we talked about earlier, there can be only one absolute infinite. One infinite, not like in mathematics, how there are higher and lower infinites, but in Vedanta, there is one absolute infinite. And if that is the case, there cannot be anything apart from it.
Correct.
So there is just one absolute reality. Since only that exists and nothing else exists, even a piece of rock is that infinite, and even a blade of grass is that infinite. Mm. And even I am an infinite. I am the infinite. Mm. The only difference between a piece of rock and me is because of the nature of my intellect, I can inquire on this and I can recognize the nature of who I am. So this is the only difference. And also, since there is only one absolute infinite, there is no relationship that I have with it. There is no becoming, there is no transformation, there is nothing. There is simply recognition of the truth of who I am. So,
yes. True, very true. See, once you know the reality about yourself, you know the reality of everything.
Everything.
This is the sum and substance of Vedanta. Yeah. See, for example, in the dream, when do I know that the whole dream world is unreal?
Hmm.
The first step is when I know myself.
Hmm.
It is impossible that you know the unreality of the world by not knowing yourself. The first step that happens in the dream is I become a waker.
Hmm.
And the moment I become a waker, I come to know that I'm not the dreamer, I'm the waker. Hmm. The moment I realize myself, know my own true entity, that is the moment when the dream world becomes unreal. So therefore, the focus of the entire Advaita Vedanta is only one, know yourself as you are.
Hmm.
Unless we know ourselves, we can never know the nature of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Many times we commit this mistake. We try to know the nature of the world without knowing ourselves. This is a mistake.
Yeah. Like literally a piece of rock and a blade of grass is just the same. It is all the infinite. And like if we go on inquiring on this, Swamiji, it seems the reality is very strange, isn't it? Like,
see, you know where we make the mistake? Hmm. When we analyze this rock, we get into atoms and subatomic particles and all. That is it's a wrong direction.
Correct.
What is the right direction? That rock, where is it seen? It is seen in my mind.
Hmm.
My mind. It is nothing but a thought in my mind. Hmm. Mind is nothing but flow of thoughts. Hmm. Where are these thoughts? These thoughts are existing in consciousness.
Hmm.
So what is the essence of this rock? It is nothing but consciousness. This is how we have to, again and again, every outer thing should take me into my own within.
Mm.
That is a way of analysis.
Yeah. Everything is an appearance in consciousness. And
yes,
only consciousness exists and I am that consciousness.
Yes. Yes.
But the overall setup of the so-called reality, Swamiji, this the world that is created by Maya, like I'm doing sadhana for decades and even centuries simply to recognize the fact of who I truly am. And the person who is actually doing sadhana is ultimately, he doesn't exist. And he's doing his sadhana in a world that ultimately is not real. So this looks like a strange, you know, this is stranger than the science fiction movies and novels. This reality seems very strange. And like, I know there is no answer to the question of why this is. So what is the best answer that you have come across, Swamiji? Why is this the way it is?
See, the world is designed to take us to our own true nature.
Hmm.
It is designed that way. Whether you know it or not, accept it or not, believe it or not, the fact is the world is designed to take you to your own self. Just like the womb is designed to take the child into the world. The womb will help the child grow. But once the child has grown, the womb, the very same womb, will push the child out into the world. Isn't it? Yeah. In the same way, the world is designed to take us to our own true nature. From the tamas to the rajas, rajas to sattva, sattva to gunatita. The world is designed. You will always find that the world is designed to crush our ego. You will all observe this.
Yes.
We may try to pamper the ego, but the world is designed to crush the ego. So we call this world ICU. Crushing university. You see? The world is designed that way.
Yes. Yes.
No one can remain here pampering the ego on and on and on. Just not possible. Yeah.
The more we are attached to it, the more we suffer. The more we let go, the more we...
So we are searching for peace. Everyone in this world, insects, birds, animals, human beings, we are all searching for peace and happiness. And as we start, you know, striving for more and more peace, we come to know that it is the ego which is preventing us from gaining this peace. And once I come to know that this ego is a real villain, the real obstacle, I happily drop the ego, because what I want is not the ego. What I want is peace.
Yes.
So I happily, knowingly, consciously, joyfully drop the ego, because what I want is peace. And this dropping, the moment this ego is dropped, my true nature is revealed to myself. So therefore, this world is designed, though the world may be unreal, it may be illusion, but it has a purpose. Even an unreal thing.
Yeah, but why at all, Swamiji? Why at all the one became many? I know there is no answer to it, but...
The point is, this ignorant was beginning this. Many times we ask this question, oh, Bhagawan thought, let me become many, let me enjoy. No, there was never a time when Bhagawan became, you know, Paramatma became a Jivatma. No.
Yeah, there is only consciousness.
This ignorance is beginningless. See, this has a logical fallacy. Suppose we say that Paramatma thought, no, I am bored. First itself, that concept itself cannot come, because Paramatma cannot be bored, because he is Ananda Surupa. He is Sachidananda. How can Ananda Surupa Bhagavan become bored? That itself is illogical. Now, the second problem is, suppose he becomes a Jivatma and again gets enlightenment. What is the guarantee that again he will not get bored? So then this moksha is also impermanent. So it is illogical to say that Bhagavan decided to become many and all that. No, cannot be accepted. We were from the beginningless past, we were ignorant about our true nature. This avidya was anadi. And once we gain the knowledge, there is no way in which we can come back, because
there is nothing to come back.
Once you are experiencing infinite bliss, how can you have a desire? Desire itself is an expression of sorrow, of misery, of imperfection.
It comes from a place of lack. Coming to the nature of enlightenment, I was wondering, what is the difference between the life that we live and the life of a jnani? Obviously, the ahamvritti that is active within us right now, and as we go deeper in and deeper into this inquiry and the study of Vedanta and Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana, it slowly diminishes. Our identification slowly, it withdraws, we withdraw it. And obviously, after that point of enlightenment, the aham vritti will not be there.
Correct.
But then, if we look at the lives of so-called enlightened beings like Ramana Maharshi, Swami Chinmayananda, Vivekananda, they all have a unique personality. They still have their own individual identity. They're very different from each other. Some are very outspoken, some are very silent. But then, what carries on, Swamiji, even after enlightenment and the complete dissolution of karma and ego? So what carries on?
So the example given is in the Vedanta is like the, you know, arrow which is shot from the bow. So though I come to know that, I shouldn't have shot it, but the arrow keeps continuing. A better example in this modern world is like the fan, you know. You switch on the fan is rotating at a very high speed. When you switch off, for some time, the fan continues to rotate. Even though there is no electricity, the momentum carries the fan on and on and on. In the same way, They have gained the knowledge. Now they are totally disidentified with the body also. But the body has got certain prarabdha karma because of which it has come. Some of the karmas have to get fructified. And that prarabdha karma itself decides that this body is going to exist for such a long time. So then it is just the body which is continuing. Actually, that jivatma has stopped identifying itself with the body. He has killed the individuality, the ego. It is not there. It is just a physical body which is existing. Just like the fan rotating, we may think that electricity is still there. Actually, electricity is not there.
Yeah.
Because we have switched off. In the same way, after jnanam, after once a person gains enlightenment, it is just the physical body.
Body, I understand, Swamiji. But then the personality also. Like, we have a unique personality. This is the ego. The ego has the personality. But for them, there is no ego. But they have
they have the samskaras. In the mind has got the habits. See, mind and the body, both of them are there. Sukshma sharira and sthula sharira, both of them
physical
are there.
Physical body, subtle body. Yeah, both will
carry. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. And this is until they leave their body.
Correct, correct, correct.
Yeah. But then within the same question, Swamiji, there are examples of what we call avatars or even some great saints like Shirdi Sai Baba and Mahavatar Babaji, who is talked about a lot in the autobiography of Yogi. Even after leaving their body, it seems like they have the power to exist in a subtle form and manifest their body whenever it is needed. So how can we understand?
You see, when they say that I will come back again and again, who is this I? Are you talking of that individual ego or are you talking of consciousness, God? If they are jnanis, then that I has to be taken as consciousness. And we have no problem at all. Consciousness can take any number of manifestations.
Even in the same form again, if they, like I'm saying.
See, that means identification is there. See, somewhere through our ignorance, you know, we are considering that Mahatma also as an ignorant Mahatma identified with the body. Because we give so much of importance to body, we think that this Mahatma also is nothing but the body only.
Like there are many stories of Mahavatar Babaji appearing to many people for thousands of years, na Swamiji, like hundreds of years. So my point was, like, obviously they would have gone beyond the individual identity, but maybe they hold it at a subtle level as a tool to manifest in the world to help people.
Is that possible? Yes, that is possible.
But they're always beyond that.
Correct.
And coming to these philosophies, Swamiji, within Vedanta, I was talking with another Swamiji who studies, Dvaita Siddhanta of Madhvacharya. And I understand that since this reality is very complex, there can be infinite number of paths to it. But the destination needs to be the same, na Swamiji? The place that we go through, the place that a jnani goes through, must be same. And if I study Swami Vivekananda or Chinmayananda or Ramana Maharshi, they are all, and even Shankaracharya, it seems like they're all talking about the same thing. But then there are some philosophies like Dvaita Vedanta, where they say that the ultimate union with God is not possible. God is different. We are different, even at the absolute level. So how can we understand this differences?
See, I recently met a Dvaiti, So he was telling the same thing. I said, you give an answer in yes or no. I will ask a question. You have to give an answer in yes or no. Okay, I'm going to make a statement. Either you should say true or you should say false. Because he was going on arguing and all that. I said, God alone exists. True or false? Now he was trapped. If you say yes, that means it is Advaita.
Yeah, correct.
God alone exists means there is nothing else. So that is Advaita.
Correct.
If you say false, then you are in trouble because you can exist apart from God also. That means you have your own independent existence. That is blasphemy. You understood?
Yeah.
See, even the prayers of Dvaitis, if you say, what are the prayers? Oh God, I am nothing, you are everything. That is their prayer.
Yes.
Oh God, I am nothing, you are everything. If God is everything and I am nothing, what remains?
God only remains.
That is called Advaita.
Yeah. But how Advaita Vedanta explains Maya and this avidya as anadi, like from infinite time it is coming. But as soon as the jnana comes, it ends. Their fundamental premise, as far as I understand, is the jiva is also anadi, but he continues to be, he'll go to a different dimension and he'll continue, his existence continues for an infinite amount of time after mukti. So this is how they explained it. But
there will be a lot of logical fallacies if you accept that. Lot of logical problems will be there. Even our Upanishad, you know, Atmanastu Kamaya Sarvam Priyam Bhavati. I think it is Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Everything is lovable for my own sake.
Yeah.
So whom do I love the most? I love myself the most. You see? Yeah. I love myself the most. Meaning, I love myself infinitely. So what is the only way in which I can love God infinitely? There is only one way. God has to be myself.
Yes.
You see the logic here?
Yeah.
If God is somebody other than me, I cannot love him infinitely.
Yeah. Only God can be the independent existence. One, exactly. Only there can be one. And the scriptures time and again say, Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma, I am Atma Brahma, yes. Aham Brahmasmi, Tatvamasi.
Yes.
So there are hundreds of instances. And Swamiji, we talked a lot about Vedanta. In our channel, we talk a lot about conscious living and conscious creation. There are many people in this world to whom this knowledge is necessary, but to live their lives, they are not ready, or they are not in the place where they have to give up everything. And even Krishna has said that it is not necessary even to give up everything. But for a professional or an entrepreneur or a businessman who's engaged in their life, for them to achieve fulfillment, joy, and for them to create their lives consciously the way they truly want to live, how would Vedanta and Bhagavad Gita, these teachings can help them?
You see, if my goal of life is material prosperity, again Vedanta can help. Because what does Vedanta say? Your outer world is nothing but a manifestation of your inner thoughts. So if I can have divine thoughts in me, so those divine thoughts will automatically attract a divine world around me. So my job in life is only one thing. I need not try to set the world outside right. I don't have to change the people. What I have to do is I have to only reform my thoughts. If I can entertain good thoughts, noble thoughts, righteous thoughts, divine thoughts, automatically a beautiful world is formed around me. So therefore, it is very much a useful knowledge even for material success also.
Yes.
Very many times people think that, you know, spirituality means, you know, renouncing everything worldly. And no, not at all. When you are spiritual, material prosperity automatically gets added on to you. We never say that unless you are materially pauper, you can't progress spiritually. No, it is not right. When you are living a spiritual life, you are actually reforming your thoughts, your behavior, your speech, your character. You are trying to bring more and more purity within. And the law of this world is the more and more you become pure, the world around you also becomes pure.
Yeah.
So my job is only one thing. Let me entertain good thoughts. That's all. As a famous saying, you know, beware of your thoughts because they become your words. Beware of your words because they become your actions. Beware of your actions because they become your habits. Beware of your habits because they become your character. Beware of your character because ultimately they determine your destiny. So therefore, again, the focus is upon myself. Let me be a good person. Then automatically the world is taken care of.
They also say, yad bhavam tad bhavati, whatever you think and feel happens.
Yes.
I also always, before I had a different mindset, but now I look at money as a tool, Swamiji. And if a spiritual person is empowered with money, obviously he will do good things in this world. And and if you look at what Ramakrishna Mission and Chinmaya Mission has done for this world, obviously money is a part there. Money is the fuel that sustains the institutions. Yes. But then the actual power of money, we can see it in these institutions, how they have used it to create a better world. So coming to fulfillment, Swamiji, all of us seek fulfillment. Like That is all we want, ultimately. And the Upanishads say that it is within us. It is the ultimate source is within us. Even in a busy life, these people who are, people who are busy with their lives, what are the practices or what can they do to manifest this fulfillment within them?
See, if you see these people who are acting in a drama, they are able to act beautifully well because they know that they are not the character in the drama. They are something different. Isn't it? So in the same, we are all playing a drama in this stage of world. We all have our roles. Our roles as husband, wife, professional, father, mother. We all have our roles. We are able to play these roles beautifully well only when we truly know who we are. So the philosophy of life is hold on to the real in you and play in the realms of the unreal. Our Pooja Guruji, Swami Tejoman, used to say, Andar Rama, Bahar Drama. So this is how we have to live our life. Hold on to the real in us and then play the role, whatever we have to do in the outer world. Then there is always peace of mind and you are able to beautifully play the role because you know you are not the role. Suppose a person has to, you know, on the drama stage, he is a Gandhiji and he has to die when bullets are shot at him. He will beautifully die. That acting, why? Because he knows that there is no death. I am not dying. It is only the role which has to die and he happily dies it. He beautifully dies in the same way. When I know myself, who am I? And then when I function in the world, perform my duties and responsibilities, I am able to beautifully fulfill them. This is what the whole message of Vedanta is.
And one can simply start by studying Bhagavad Gita and some of the Upanishads to begin to live this knowledge.
So, practical spirituality is this. Let me do what I consider to be right. Let me not do something which is not right, but which I like. So there is a path of Shreyas, there is a path of praise. There is a path of good, there is a path of pleasant. There is a path which is right, and there is a path which I like. So in spirituality, if you have to really progress and purify the mind, we will have to always do what we like, what is right. The path of righteousness, the path of dharma. There is a struggle. Because always I tend to do what I like. I generally don't like what is right.
But we know what is right.
Yes, we know what is right. But we don't want to do it. We know what is wrong. But we are tempted to do it. So if we can live a life in such a way that come what may, if something is right, I'm going to live it. I'm going to do it. Come what may, if something is wrong, I'm not going to do it. If we can strictly adhere to the path of dharma, that itself will purify the mind because that struggle purifies the mind. Just like gold is purified in a hot furnace, mind is purified in such struggles, in such internal battle. And such a pure mind becomes a fit instrument to experience a higher reality. So that's all we need to do, nothing else. So in everyone can practice this in their own field, in their own profession. They don't have to escape from this world.
Yes. And the common objection to Advaita Vedanta, Swamiji, that I have got from the scientific community and the atheists and all that, since Advaita Vedanta is very scientific and it is logical, most of what it says, everyone has to agree because it is just asking us to look at our own self, the nature of our own mind. But the one place is the infinite consciousness that we are. What they say is, let's say if someone is in anesthesia and if they are unconscious or something, the outside reality is going on as it were, right? The outside world is not dependent on the infinite consciousness that is within a person. And this is the contradiction that they point to. Like if there is one consciousness, how can we validate with science is the question. So, is there a way to do it?
There is no way. Because the very direction of science is wrong. Yes, it is outward. And it has assumed the existence of an observer. It doesn't do any inquiry into the observer. It is only focused upon the observed entity. This is the mistake. Whereas Vedanta says everything is observable only. There is nothing called observed. observer is the thing, is the reality. And they have ignored the reality and they are going after illusion. So just imagine a person who is doing a lot of research in the dream world, about the dream world. Will he ever know the reality? Never. Any amount of research in the illusory world can never take you to the reality. In fact, Kathopanishad says, Paranchi khani vyatranat swayambhu tasmat parang pashyate nantaratman kaschit dhira pratyatmanam aikshat avritta chakshuhu amrutattvam icchan. It says the senses, God has killed the sense organs by making it extrovert. The entire direction of science is extrovertedness. They believe only what they see, what they hear. And Upanishad says, God has killed these sense organs, cursed these sense organs. So if you follow the path of sense organs, you are going to be cheated. Very rare few. It is a kaschid dhiraha pratyagatmanam aikshata. They go within. They go into oneself. And then they attain the state of immortality.
But so one thing, Swamiji, what I think will happen very soon with science is, since the outside world is the projection of Maya, it is an appearance. What they're finding more and more is this, because of the advent of quantum physics and all that, they're saying now matter is nothing. And they're saying gravitational force, the time-space reality, which they assumed was the fundamental foundation for this reality. Now the Nobel laureate has said that the time-space reality is not fundamental. The gravitational force is not fundamental. So what they're finding, of course, they cannot find consciousness, but what they're finding is the world is an appearance. Maybe that they will be soon able to find, just like how Shankaracharya said, but the way he said it in through his understanding was different.
But the thing is, how is this knowledge going to help me? It is not going to help me. Rather, it will only destroy me.
Correct.
Now, what is the purpose of life? Eat, drink, do all kinds of unwanted things, because anyway, nothing exists.
Correct.
So there is no purpose of life. There is no purpose in disciplining the sense organs. There is no purpose in meditation. There is no purpose in spiritual sadhana, because everything is nothing. It's a very tragic philosophy. Don't say that Advaita Vedanta and this becomes one because they have proved that the world doesn't exist. No, it is a very dangerous philosophy. Because Vedanta also says that you are everything. World is nothing, no doubt. But you, the consciousness, you are everything. Therefore, gain that. So there is a purpose in life.
From that perspective, you can say world is nothing. Not by being within the world, we cannot say the world is nothing.
Exactly.
This is like we understood, this is simply the recognition of our own true nature. And even for serious seekers and who practice this for years together, like, why is it so difficult to get, Swamiji?
See, actually, the path is very, very simple. Theoretically, the path is very simple. The only thing we have to do is just drop the ego. And when we just observe ourselves, you know, it is so easy to drop the ego. I am alive. How many factors are needed to keep myself alive? Infinite factors. And not even one factor is in my control. Food, shelter, clothing, you know, outside, gravitation, humidity, etc. Inside, liver, kidney, I don't know how they are functioning. I don't know how the brain is functioning. I don't know how the eyes are functioning, ears are functioning. So the world is designed in such a way so that we can easily drop the ego. When we analyze the realities of life, we come to know, I am nothing, I know nothing, I can do nothing, I have nothing. It's a fact of life. Isn't it? Just observe the realities of life and we come to know that we are nothing. That's all what the qualification is necessary to know the truth. In Bhagavad Gita, it is said, Amanitum. Amanitum means be humble. And once you are humble and open-minded, knowledge and humility, they go together.
Correct.
Arrogance and ignorance, they go together. So actually, this path is not at all difficult. It's very, very easy. You have to just become humble and be open-minded. That's all what is needed. And this consciousness is my own self. It is so very evident and clear in a pure mind.
And the more we go into it, the more fulfilled we are. So that is there. So that results are there. But then I'm talking about that absolute fulfillment, that infinite consciousness.
The more and more you drop the ego, the more and more there is fulfillment.
Yes, definitely.
There is more and more peace. There is more and more contentment. That itself becomes an inspiration to put forth more effort.
Correct. So
that itself is a proof that you are going in the right direction.
Right direction. Yes.
You can never leave this path. Once you start experiencing the joy, that fulfillment, then you start putting more and more effort. And once you start putting more and more effort, the cosmos has to create a conducive environment for you to realize the self.
Yeah.
Once the desire becomes single-pointed, then the path is, you know, it's a cakewalk.
Yeah, absolutely. And before, like when I was young, I always had this ambition of building a business or something like that. And recently I was telling my mother, even if there is an option to get $1 billion versus giving up Upanishads, I can never choose that path now. Like it's not like that is not important, but without this, that is nothing. Like
Exactly. Yeah. And the more and more you understand the importance of this, the more and more you understand the insignificance of everything else.
Yes, absolutely.
So that's how it is. So therefore, this path is very easy. Yeah. Only thing is you have to have an open-mindedness to know the reality and be humble. That's all what is needed.
And practice it every day.
Yes.
And whatever the negativity, whatever comes in our mind, we should simply witness it, right, Swamiji? We should simply
surrender unto God. Sometimes witnessing may not work. The best way is, Bhagwan, you take care of me. I am not able to handle this. That sincere surrender. You know, one thing, the intensity of this negative emotion is directly connected to the ego. Greater the ego, greater will be the intensity of this, and greater will be our helplessness. See, ego can never handle this negative emotion because ego itself is an illusory entity. An illusory entity can never have real power. They cannot go together. Just like my shadow cannot have power. Shadow is an illusion. It has no real power. In the same way, ego can never have real power because it doesn't exist. So therefore, the problem is we try to win over this negative emotion remaining as an ego. That is a problem. The moment we connect to God, surrender unto God, then you will find that these negative emotion just vanishes very easily. So your real strength is in the strength of surrender.
Yeah.
Your real effort is the effort of surrender, actually speaking.
Correct. And since we are the ultimate witness, and since that witness witnesses everything, the ultimate jump, like you said, we cannot witness the witness. The ultimate thing has to be a grace, or there has to be some kind of a jump that is needed. And all we can do is surrender. All we can do is...
Correct. Shifting the attention. Surrender means, in the language of knowledge, shifting the attention to that reality, to consciousness.
Seeing oneness in everything, can we put it that way? Seeing...
Yes.
And Swamiji, coming to the last question, you have studied a lot of scriptures, and based on all of your learnings and understanding, Swamiji, within a few sentences, if you had to put the nature of reality so that a person can understand it, if you can sum it all up, what would you say reality is?
See, there is a very famous statement which I love very much. It says, no God, no peace. No God, no peace. The first one is no God, N-O God, N-O peace. The second one is K-N-O-W God, K-N-O-W peace. So in the same way, when we come to know that this God is our own self, and when we start paying attention to that self more and more, giving priority to the self, again and again shifting our attention to that self, slowly everything auspicious start manifesting in your life. So this is all what we need to do. And this is a single message of all the scriptures. Shift your attention to the self in you. It is always there. Our suffering is because we ignore the reality. We don't pay attention to this God, to this reality. We discard this reality. This is a great sin. That God is doing everything for us. He is keeping us alive. He has given us abilities and talents. He has created a world for us. Everything he's doing. And then I don't give credit to him. I say, I did it. This is a great sin. And we are paying the price for that sin by being born again and again to this world.
Yes.
So turn to God and everything will be fine. Everything will be fine. That's all.
Yes. Thank you, Swami. Wonderfully put. And Swamiji, first of all, I would like to thank you so much for giving your time. And I would like to express sincere gratitude for the work that you are doing, for the work that Chinmaya Mission is doing. Sir, there is so much of darkness in this world, and so much of wars are going on, so much of division. And even within the Sanatana Dharma, it pains me to see some institutions taking people in the wrong direction. It was never the case with Sanatana Dharma that only this God is right, only that system is right. So out of all this, institutions like Chinmaya Mission are, you know, preserving the wealth of knowledge of Sanatana Dharma in the right way, the teachings of Vedanta. So thank you a lot. And a lot of gratitude to the institution as well. And if people want to listen to you, Swamiji, if they want to listen to your lectures, where can they find you, Swami?
See, there is a YouTube channel, Chinmaya Mission Mangalore. So all the talks are anyway uploaded there.
Okay.
So they can access all those talks there.
Thanks a lot, Swamiji. Namaste.
Thank you, Sujanji. It was very nice, you know, talking to you and discussing all these wonderful points.
Thank you, Swamiji. It was
and you are also doing a wonderful job.
Thank you, Swamiji. Thank you.
Hello there. If you wish to understand the true nature of reality and learn about consciousness, conscious creation, and the teachings of the ancient Vedanta in order to live your life with purpose, achieve fulfillment, and consciously create a life that you truly want to live, then you can join our community Come Learning platform, the Advaita Conscious Society. For more information, visit advaita.com. Thank you.